U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
As 2021 comes to a close in Washington, how do we size up President Biden's first year in office, and what else happened that's worth remembering? Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, columnists Bill McGurn and Kim Strassel. Bill, let's start at the 30,000-foot level. Huge story, of course, in Washington, always every 4 years, is a new boss in town. January 20th, President Joe Biden inaugurated, ushered into the White House, a job that he first sought more than 30 years before during the 1988 presidential campaign. And now he's here. He has it. Bill, how do you think his first year in office has gone?
Well, I think now, especially with the defeat of Build Back Better, I think that it's looking more and more like a disaster. You know, I trace it mostly not to, the trouble he's had with this signature piece of domestic legislation, but to the withdrawal from Afghanistan. It was a disaster. The world saw it was a disaster. We left Americans behind. There are still Americans behind, not to mention the thousands of people who worked for us. We saw his callous attitude when he was asked about people, you know, trying to cling to the wheel wells of our departing jets and dying, you know, when they fell off. And he said, come on, man, that was 5 days ago. And I think the real scandal of this, and it speaks to the larger themes of his presidency, is that he did that, I believe, solely for the purpose of being able to announce on September 11th, the 20th anniversary of September 11th, that he was the commander in chief who had brought all our troops home from Afghanistan. There was no reason to have that timeline except for vanity. And I think all these other things are showing. And one of the interesting things is when Joe Biden campaigned for the nomination against his fellow Democrats, he stressed his experience. And he's right. Like, he had 36 years in the Senate and, you know, his years as vice president. No one had more experience than he did. And we see that the value of that is not always good, you know, and especially in the Senate, because in the Senate, I think someone like Joe Biden that goes on and some old coot telling these stories that no one's much interested in, you know, you can thrive in the Senate doing that. But as president, you need an executive willing to stand up, take responsibility for things. And, you know, we don't see him for periods of time. He doesn't answer a lot of questions from the press. So I think it's been an extraordinary year, and that a man that came in hailed as FDR is now looking more and more like Jimmy Carter.
Well, Bill brings up Afghanistan, so let's start there. A part of what I think made that so damaging was the disconnect between what was happening on the ground and what President Biden said. And we have a clip of him in August.
No nation has ever done anything like it in all of history. Only the United States had the capacity and the will and ability to do it, and we did it today. The extraordinary success of this mission was due to the incredible skill, bravery, and selfless courage of the United States military and our diplomats and intelligence professionals.
And at that time, remember, the White House was saying there were only about 100 or 200 Americans still in Afghanistan who wanted to leave. Here's a statement from the State Department last week. Since August 31, the United States has directly assisted 479 American citizens and 450 lawful permanent residents to depart Afghanistan and relocate to the United States. So obviously 479 American citizens is a bigger number than 100 or 200 American citizens. And that's not even counting the thousands of people who had these visas for being translators or helping U.S. forces there. And to Bill's point, if you look at the polling averages, literally, it's August 30th that Joe Biden goes underwater in the polling average for 538, at least. And obviously, there's some coincidence in that exact date. But it looks like Afghanistan, Kim, really has had an effect on his approval.
Absolutely. And that's because it wasn't just the evacuation that was botched. The entire procedure was botched. And it was the sight of the president pretty clearly saying that he had taken actions that were at odds with what a lot of his military advisors and others had suggested he do. Remember, he decided to set that firm deadline of the day we were going to leave. People advised him not to do that. There was a precipitous decision to close the airbase. And military advisors later explained that they really had no choice, given that Joe Biden was unwavering in his demands that we reduce to a certain troop level by a certain date. So they did not have the ability to hold all of these different places in Afghanistan. There was the president suggesting that nobody, the White House suggesting that nobody could possibly know that the Taliban would take over so quickly, when in fact there were a lot of people warning about just that. And then, of course, the botched evacuation and the untruths that were told from the White House podium about how many people were there, how many people are still there. The White House would rather not talk about this and pretend it isn't around, but the media continues to dutifully point out that there are still a lot of people that we promised we would not leave behind, who we have left behind. And so it's continuing bad headline for them. And yes, I think you trace a lot of the woes to that time in September, not just in terms of public approval, but whenever those public approvals go down, it becomes harder for members of your own party to stick with you because you're not necessarily the winner anymore.
Another big story, one hard to evade, is COVID-19, which, alas, is still with us as we are heading into 2022. And Bill, an interesting piece of news is on December 14th, just recently, Biden issued a statement to mark the tragic milestone of 800,000 American deaths due to COVID-19, unquote. And of course, the president only has some tools at his disposal to deal with a pandemic like this, not a large amount of tools. And sometimes he's trying to do things like these vaccine mandates that are getting blocked by the courts. But what's interesting here is the contrast with what Biden said in the 2020 campaign. He was speaking about President Trump at the time. He said, anyone who is responsible for that many deaths should not remain as president of the United States of America, unquote. And that was when the U.S. had recorded about 220,000 COVID deaths. And so part of the lesson, I think, of this is that the pandemic is not under the control of politicians.
Yeah, it's always hard to live by the standards you set for other politicians if you're a Paul. Almost always comes back to bite you. Look, I think Joe Biden was wrong when he said that about President Trump, for the reasons you point out, that actually there's not much directly a president can do. Now, I do think President Trump did what a president could do in terms of developing this vaccine in record time, which I think mostly is about getting out of the way. Going to the private sector, saying, what do you need? What do you need us not to do? And getting out of the way. But I think, again, it's a curious tick of Joe Biden's. Like, during the campaign, he said all these things that senators like to say about presidents of the other party, you know, how he's wrong. And if I were president, things would be different, you know. And, you know, he promised to shut down COVID and so forth. And as you point out, there are a lot more deaths under Joe Biden. The larger thing, again, I go back to is that Joe Biden's rhetoric is his worst enemy, his own ambitions, because he sets out things that he can't do. And I think it just contributes to this feeling that started with Afghanistan, extends to the border, and extends also to COVID, that he's just not the man for the job. The job is too big for him. He's overwhelmed by it. And again, part of that is he's politicized a lot of things, and that may have helped him get elected. But I think it's making him look weak, unnecessarily weak, as a president.
I agree with Bill here that the heroes of this COVID situation, maybe they're not unsung heroes, are the people and the companies, the pharmaceutical companies who are developing, manufacturing, distributing these vaccines. And just to check in again with the numbers from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, they say that about 500 million vaccines have been administered in the United States as the year is coming to a close. 204 million people have been fully vaccinated. 61 million people have gotten booster doses. And Kim, now we have the Omicron variant, and maybe there will be more variants to come. But to the extent that normal life came back in large swaths of the United States in 2021, these vaccines have a lot to do with it.
Absolutely. I mean, the innovation has just been stunning. And let's now add to that as well to the news that Pfizer is putting out this new COVID pill, which apparently if you take within, 3 to 5 days of exhibiting symptoms, protects dramatically against hospitalization. And again, that is another pharmaceutical wonder. One other thing just to mention, too, about these vaccine makers is not just the innovation of creating the vaccines, but and it gets overlooked, but the extraordinary logistics behind ramping those things up and getting them ready to roll out even before they had been approved. I mean, it was kind of a feat of supply management. And the Trump administration gets credit for that as well, too, because remember how this came to be. They placed a whole bunch of bets on a whole bunch of companies and actually geared up and manufactured, not even knowing which ones would make it or which ones would get approval. It was really Operation Warp Speed was really pretty something remarkable to see. Now, I should point out, look, I think Joe Biden's administration gets credit for getting those vaccines out to people. There was already a network in place to begin doing that, and it had already started. They certainly didn't get in the way of it. But I think the surprise to me is that they nonetheless continued, as Bill said, to suggest that there was more that they could do. You know, the president put out a 198-page plan in January when he came into office, which is going to suggest that they were going to quash this virus in a matter of months. Well, here we are at the end of the year. It was an impossible expectation, one of the White House shouldn't have set. And if they had from the beginning simply vowed that the goal was to get everyone back to normality, mainly by producing vaccines for all those willing to take them, and then also supplied consistent advice instead of the constantly changing rules we've been getting, they'd be in a far better political place right now.
The pandemic, despite that success, though, has still left the economy in a strange place. Record numbers of job openings, employers having trouble finding workers, all of these supply chain hangups we've seen, including at American ports, and inflation. These inflation figures, 6.8% in November, compared with the same month a year ago, the fastest pace since 1982. And Bill, recall that the first big piece of legislation that President Biden signed was this $1.9 trillion COVID relief plan, which came on top of all of the COVID relief passed in 2020. How responsible, Bill, do you think that $1.9 trillion injection of money is for these inflation figures that we're seeing now?
Well, I think it played a role. And of course, the fear over BBB was that it would inject even more money there for this. So, the interesting thing is that all the experts who are supposed to track these and tell us completely misread it, right? They completely misread the system. First, they denied the inflation. Then they said it was transitory. Now we're being told it's not so transitory. We were then told Build Back Better would fix it. I think it's going to be with us for some time. And of course, the longer it goes, the greater the pain when you try to combat it.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
Wall Street Journal.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. One final theme that I would pull out here from Biden's year, and it's hard, but take yourself back to January 20th, 2021. And the story of the Democratic primary election the previous year had been progressive voters trying to push Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren over the top and being stymied by moderate Democrats, including African-American Democrats in states like South Carolina, who wanted Joe Biden instead. And it's true that Biden campaigned on big plans. His Green New Deal that he put out during the campaign would have cost $1.7 trillion. It included a call for a coast-to-coast high-speed rail network. But Kim, then he comes into office. He gets a 50-50 Senate. He has a chance to pitch to the middle of the American electorate. And he simply doesn't do it. How do you explain that?
It's hard to account for it, but I think it comes down to a lack of leadership. And this is just growing more evident as you watch Joe Biden in office. You have to remember that he was for decades a senator. And what do senators do? They all get together and chum around and negotiate and all kind of settle on a middle. That's when they're actually working together. That's what Joe Biden likes to do. He's a deal maker. But when you're in the White House, you need to lead. And so the strategy this entire year seems to have been like, well, how can we keep our progressives happy? How do we get to a deal that everybody's good with? And managing or trying to please, I should say, rather that ascendant wing of the party, rather than looking out, looking at the polls, remembering the history of that primary that you just laid out, and understanding that the path to political success rests in a kind of center right, or at least center left strategy that appeals or would be at least tolerable to the vast part of the country. And if you're going to try to make Pramila Jayapal, the head of the Progressive Caucus, happy, you're destined to end up in a policy place that most Americans can't support. So, I mean, that would be the only way I can describe it. You know, he came out of that primary. That was his attitude from the very beginning when he decided to go over and break bread with Bernie Sanders and say, hey, why don't you let your people come up with all of my agenda going forward? They've never backed off of that, no matter how bad the polls show it is failing.
Bill, how about the year for President Trump, the outgoing president? Of course, we should talk about the Capitol riot on January 6th. As we close the year here, more than 700 people have been charged with crimes committed in connection with that event. Here's a piece of a news report just last week. It says, quote, a Florida man who hurled a fire extinguisher at police officers during some of the most ferocious fighting at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th was sentenced on Friday to more than 5 years in prison. That is reportedly the longest sentence that has been handed down so far. Bill, how much do you think that this and the aftermath has damaged President Trump's standing, and particularly as we go toward 2024, where he keeps hinting he might be a candidate for office again?
Yeah, I don't know how much it's damaged his standing, because if you read the polls and within the Republican Party, it certainly polarized the country. But within the Republican Party, I think he would still be the preferred candidate. I'm not sure how much that's going to hold up. For me, I think the more damaging thing for Donald Trump, and if he had any ambitions to run again this year, would be that when he was still president and he had lost the election, but there were two elections open in Georgia. You know, he went down, he did campaign for the candidates and so forth, but he kind of forced them first to back his claims about stolen election and so forth. Anyway, they both lost. I think if he had gone all out for those candidates, saying we got to stop Democrats from having full control in Washington, I think if he had gone all out and just put his own prestige on the line fully, and in a sustained way, they might have won. And if they did win, we would be spared a lot of what we're seeing now in terms of legislation, in terms probably of approval of judges and so forth. So to me, that was where he was most short-sighted. I'm personally of the view that he's not going to run again, but no one who wants to be influential in Washington is ever going to say that, because then people stop paying attention to him. By keeping it a wild card until the last minute, first of all, he buys time to make the decision. You know, things could change very differently in 6 months. I think he's not going to say that. And the result is there are a lot of other candidates that are in limbo, because their plans might change drastically if they thought Donald Trump was running again. So we'll see what the new year brings. Again, I'm kind of still betting that he's not going to do it, because it's a tough thing to run for president. And the last time he ran for president, he was president. You had Air Force One, you had all this. Yes, he does have his own jet, but it's not quite the same thing. And he's older. It's just not easy. You know, you really have to have the fire in your belly. And one of the differences now between now and 2016, when he ran in 2016, I think he had a pretty clear agenda that he articulated to the American people. I didn't agree with all of it, but I agree with a lot of it, you know. And now I don't really hear an agenda. He might criticize Joe Biden, you know, for reversing some of his things. You know, a lot of it seems to be about, you know, getting even with people whom he believes sold him out. I'm not sure, again, that's a winning formula for him. And I do think he does not want to go through an election where he thinks he will lose.
With regard to these stolen election and vote fraud charges, though, 2021, we're not kind to them. First, we had this Arizona audit, which returned and found some discrepancies in voter files that couldn't be explained, some that the auditors clearly misunderstood. There was a report by a Republican legislator who leads a committee in Michigan. He looked at the election in Michigan and essentially said that there were clear weaknesses in our election system that require remedy, but there's no evidence of fraud. That report even called for an investigation into people who were claiming fraud and using it for their own ends, maybe to fundraise. And then just recently, a few weeks ago, there was a conservative policy shop in Wisconsin that wrote a very comprehensive 136-page report. It says there's no evidence of widespread voter fraud. In all likelihood, more eligible voters cast ballots for Joe Biden than Donald Trump, unquote. And so, Kim, on the one hand, the proof that Trump has been calling for hasn't been coming out. On the other hand, the obvious thing to me in the wake of the Capitol riot for Congress to do would be to change the Electoral Count Act rules. That's the law that purportedly gives Congress the ability to throw out electors, which is what Trump wanted on January 6th. And instead of doing that, Congress has spent the whole year talking about these massive bills like H.R. 1 that would overrule voting laws nationwide. And again, just like Build Back Better, look like they don't have the support of 50 senators.
Yeah, when I think of the words election integrity, I always these days divide it into two different buckets. You know, there are the claims that Trump has made and continued to claim that there are massive fraud and that, you know, people basically managed to shift tens of thousands of votes in a way that denied him the ability to be president. I mean, as you said, there is simply no good evidence out there. There have been some tiny little cases where people have found discrepancies here and there. But the bigger point is not enough and not on the scale to get you anywhere clear or anywhere near what Donald Trump says would change the election. Now, that's very different from what you just touched on, which is, did Democrats work extremely hard during the first year of COVID to completely water down a lot of voting rules and change them all on the grounds that we had a COVID emergency in ways that they felt would advantage them at the polls? For instance, some of the states that allowed either legislatively or because courts imposed things like ballot harvesting, et cetera. And then how naked they have been since then about wanting to pass legislation at the federal level that would impose this voting regime on every one of the 50 states from Washington. Thankfully, that's been blocked in part because, yay, Joe Manchin will not break the filibuster. But that's going to be the voting debate going forward. You've seen several states respond by passing their own voter integrity bills, which are designed to try to recoup some of the confidence that a lot of Americans lost in the election. And I think that that's really, sadly, the real consequence of Donald Trump continuing to do this is not just January 6th, but, you know, Republicans lost Georgia in those Senate runoffs because he wouldn't quit harping about voter fraud. And he made people believe that their vote wouldn't be counted. And so they didn't bother to come out. And if that's going to continue to be his message in the 2022 midterms or the next presidential election, you know, good luck to Republicans.
One last thought on January 6th, which is the impeachment that took place as a result of that. In the end, Donald Trump was acquitted by the Senate in February. The vote was 57 to 43. And there was some of those Republicans were saying they weren't sure that they could impeach or convict a former president. So there was that issue. But that gets to the dilemma that Democrats had in the wake of January 6th, which is they could do an impeachment fast, try to get it through before Trump left office on January 20th, or they could do it slow and take their time and investigate and make the argument that it was possible to impeach and convict a former office holder. And they decided to do the first of those options. But Bill, to my eye, the result of this is that impeachment has kind of disappeared into the mists. And yet this House committee, this January 6th committee, might have a bigger long-term effect in that it is going through and issuing subpoenas and pulling some real actual information into the light.
Yeah, I'm not as hopeful about the committee. I just think that, you know, both the pro-Trump and anti-Trump sides have hardened their positions. I would like to get an honest assessment of what happened on January 6th, but I think it's I think the truth is that Donald Trump is now, especially with Joe Biden's disasters overseas and his disasters in Congress, failing to get his top piece of legislation through, Donald Trump is the only card that the Democrats have left, and they're going to play it. And I'm not sure it's going to be as strong this time when you have such a weak president as it was last time. And it'll certainly be incendiary. We'll see all that. But I'm just, I think so much of this is driven for the reason they were used, including Joe Biden. You know, the main campaign theme was, I'm not Donald Trump. I'm going to be quiet and normal and, you know, look quietly after your prosperity and rebuild America's standing in the world. Well, he hasn't done any of those things. And I'm just not sure the Trump card is going to be as potent as it was the last time.
So those are a few of the political highlights in Washington as we close out the year. Kim, is there another story that you think deserves a few more words as we get to the end of the year here?
Yes, I do. It's one very close to my heart. I think the other big story of this year, though the media doesn't want to talk about it, is the findings that have come up from U.S. Special Counsel John Durham, who obviously was appointed by the former Attorney General Bill Barr to investigate the origins of this Russia collusion hoax. We have found out some remarkable things over the course of this year. In September, he came out and indicted Michael Sussman, a former Perkins Coie lawyer, who, for lying to the FBI, coming in and presenting supposed evidence of Russian collusion and telling the FBI that he was, or intimating to the FBI that he was simply handing this over as a good citizen, when in fact he was working with the Clinton campaign. We have subsequently had the indictment of Danchenko, a Russian national who, it turns out, was the main source for nearly all of the accusations against Donald Trump in the infamous Steele dossier. It turns out he wasn't some knowledgeable Russian working within the Kremlin, but a guy in America who was close to Democratic circles, had his own ties with Democrats connected to the Clinton campaign. So this, it turns out, what we're seeing is an enormous, dirty political trick. We had to kind of guess at that beforehand. Now we've got more of the details and the characters and how everything rolled out. This is a great disservice. It's a real condemnation of the media, who itself failed to figure any of this out prior to now. Also of Special Counsel Bob Mueller, who had his own opportunity and looked into this for a very long time and didn't manage to divulge any of this to the U.S. public. So that was a really big story this year.
One that I would pick out is human spaceflight and the billionaire space race. There's a recent story saying that the launch on Saturday was the 13th human spaceflight of the year. That's the most, more than 1985, when there were 9 shuttle launches and 2 Russian launches. People are going up so fast that the FAA is ending its practice of giving people commercial astronaut wings because there's too many people that are getting them now. Jeff Bezos went up. William Shatner went up. And it's hard to predict the long-term benefits of this, but these companies are competing. They're lowering the cost of going to orbit. There are companies that are working on constellations of satellites to beam internet to remote areas. If you could beam the internet into a place like Cuba, that would do a huge world of good. And for all the griping about these billionaires spending their money on this, one other reminder I would throw out is that after the space shuttle retired, the U.S. was paying Russia for rides to the International Space Station. And I would much rather have Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos competing for that business than be paying Putin to do it. So, Bill, we will give you the last word on 2021 if you have a story you want to pick out.
Yeah, no, first I would agree with you. I mean, to me, the space issue, like I see William Shatner, who's 90, on Medicare commercials, you know, when he was on one of his flights. I think science is all about expanding our boundaries, you know, making what was once extraordinary, ordinary, and we don't always notice it. I would just add to the list that I think the big impact is going to be on the Supreme Court, which took some big cases on abortion, on gun rights, on public funding for religious schools. And they may take up, which I hope they'll take up, they're considering a case about race preferences in college admissions. So, you know, a long sort of 50-year conservative project to appoint good judges and reform the Supreme Court. I mean, we may be seeing the fruits of that, you know, in the next few months.
Thank you, Bill and Kim. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.